The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Do you love history but hate when it's stuffy and boring? Well, look no further and join me, Katie Charlwood, your friend, the neighborhood social scientist and reader of books, as I delve into unsolved historical mysteries, murders by gaslight, and of course, women who have been misrepresented through all time. On Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It began long ago. Two young boys in an American town riding their bikes to school and little league practice. Over the years, the boys became fast friends, united in their love for stories where things would go horribly wrong. Pour yourself a strong beverage and buckle up. You're in the Shallow End with Schnepley and Toth.
Episode 77 of The Shallow End with Schnepley and Toth. If we appear to be talking faster than normal, it's because this is the first podcast episode of this show that we've done under a duress of time.
Yeah, we have a time limit.
JG loses power in roughly 57 minutes. So if this episode sucks, we're going to blame it on the faulty electricity schedule in Ecuador.
Yeah, it's been a little bit better recently. The rolling blackouts went from 4 hours a day to 2 hours a day, and not 7 days a week, just 5 days a week. So it's getting better.
See?
But yeah. So I'm going to take the positive where I can find it.
There you go.
And right now, I'm loving the fact that we don't have to go 4 hours a day without electricity.
So in view of the fact that you could lose electricity earlier than scheduled, maybe you should go first.
All right. Well, I've got something prepared for you.
I want Lovely.
To, it's about the Clifton Suspension Bridge, which is above an awe-inspiring 700-foot-wide Avon Gorge in Bristol, England.
Now, good grief.
You know the kind of bridge that I'm talking about, the big arch.
Yes.
Yeah, right. It's huge.
Suspension bridge.
And it's been there for a while now, and it has quite a history of daredevils and death-defying stunts that have lured thrill seekers for generations to this bridge. It's an engineering marvel. It was completed in the 19th century. It's been around for a while.
Wow.
Yeah. And so these daredevil feats have been going on for quite some time. It's like a magnet for individuals seeking to prove their mettle. One notable incident, one of the earliest ones that I could find, goes all the way back to 1885. A woman named...
Meaning there were shallow end people even back then.
19th century shallow enders. Sarah Ann Henley. Now, this was an unintentional daredevil stunt, but it worked out that way. She was in a heated argument with her boyfriend, and she was very upset, and they were near Avon Gorge, and she made a desperate leap from the bridge. She threw herself off of this bridge.
Oh, good grief.
But again, it was 1885, and fashions were different then.
Sure.
She had a
big hoop skirt and bustle.
Right. And petticoats.
Layers and layers of petticoats. And
yeah. Her dress acted like a parachute. like you'd see in a cartoon, just and she drifted slowly into the river. Well, not really slowly, but it slowed her down enough so that
slow enough that she wasn't killed.
Right, she survived. Throughout the years, people would do all kinds of death-defying things, handstands on the rails, and those sorts of things. Fast forward to 1957, when a flying officer for the Royal Air Force seized the spotlight with this stunt. He was he was piloting a vampire jet, and he was in the vicinity of the suspension bridge and thought he would prove himself by flying under the bridge.
Between the bridge and the river.
Right.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
At a speed of 450 miles per hour.
Now, you said this bridge is roughly 700 feet over the over the river?
About 700 feet.
Okay.
Which it's a, is a lot when you're jumping off the bridge with only like a petticoat to to save you.
But when you're coming in at Mach 2.
In a vampire jet, a little different.
That's probably a different story.
So he comes in, he makes his approach, 450 miles per hour, under the bridge, and he made it out the other side. He had a momentary celebration right before his jet disintegrated against the unforgiving cliff walls on the south side of the gorge.
No.
Yes.
No, sir, sir.
Good man.
That's just... poor piloting, sir. That's crazy.
Yeah, I know. It's insane. These incidents prompted authorities to crack down on stunting.
Post a sign on the bridge. Absolutely no jets may be flown under this bridge. This means you.
They did toughen their rules and regulations. They put them in place to deter any further underflights, over jumps, or other reckless behaviors on or around the bridge. Bungee jumping in particular in the modern era was explicitly prohibited.
I can imagine.
Yeah, because once bungee jumping became popular,
a thing.
Yeah, this was definitely a goal for a lot of people. Base jumping, same thing. Can't do that off the bridge. But despite these strict measures, the Clifton Suspension Bridge remains a tempting challenge for those willing to defy the odds. It continues to beckon individuals like James, a daring 22-year-old who disregarded the established rules but did live to recount his adventure.
Oh boy, okay.
Here we go.
James, be glad we're not using your last name.
James Marples in 2004.
Oopsie.
22-year-old thrill seeker and bungee jumper from Sheffield, England, found himself yearning for an adrenaline rush. Now, this is a common thing for people who are thrill seekers and daredevils. They have a different, their mind, their brain is wired differently.
Sure,
they experience adrenaline in a different way. For me, it's the type of adrenaline rush I get when I, like one of my distant ancestors was about to be eaten by a bear.
Right.
It's not pleasant for me, but for a lot of people like James, it is. It's that heart pounding sense of tingling that they get. So he looks upon the majestic Clifton Suspension Bridge and a daring idea took root in his mind. It was a desire to do something extraordinary, not just jump off the bridge, not just bungee, but something that would etch his name in the annals of audacious feats. So the idea percolated in his brain for a few days. He contemplated the rush of adrenaline, the soaring sensation of defying gravity, and the intoxicating thrill of living life on the edge. And perhaps it was the appeal of fleeting fame, the yearning for the moment in the spotlight, or simply just this insatiable hunger for excitement that drove him forward. With each passing day, his plan began to take shape. He spent a lot of time working on it. He scoured the internet for information on the bridge. He studied its structure and plotted his descent meticulously.
Good for him.
As he acquired the necessary equipment, I guess, you know, leading up to something like that for a person like this, the anticipation of it must be part of the thrill, I would think.
I would think so.
Yeah. So he's getting pretty excited about this. And finally, the day came, the moment when James stood at the precipice of his endeavor, climbing over the railings and crossing the point of no return. He felt a rush of emotions. He had his bungee cord attached. He was feeling a combination of fear, exhilaration, and determination. The wind was blowing pretty hard that day.
Oh, boy.
But everything else seemed like a go. As he leaped from the towering bridge, a sense of freedom washed over him.
Okay.
I'm speculating here. I don't know. The world blurred around him, and for a few breathtaking seconds, he was suspended in time and space. But James had more in store for this particular stunt. He wasn't going to just bungee off the bridge. His full
plan... Of course not.
No. His full plan was this. Bungee jump off the suspension bridge. When he got to the point where the bungee would snap him back, he would light gasoline, his gasoline-soaked clothing on fire. And then, as the bungee cord tightened up again, as he was descending, he would cut the bungee cord with a knife and plunge into the river, thus extinguishing the flames. And then, of course,
a perfect plan.
Swim off to glory, I guess.
Perfect plan.
Yeah. So he jumps off the bridge. He reaches the point where he begins to feel the tension of the bungee cord tightening, and he flicks his lighter. James burst into flame. He watched the blaze as it danced around him, and he quickly reached for his knife to cut himself free. But even after all of his meticulous planning, he did overlook a tiny detail. He didn't either sharpen the knife, or at the very least, he didn't test it to see how quickly it would cut through the bungee. So he was dangling there over the river all on fire and stuff.
Sure.
For about 26 seconds.
Sure he was.
It took him 26 seconds to cut through the rope. He plunged into the river below. It was a fiery spectacle. And then swam off. I'm sure a mix of pain and adrenaline coursing through his body. One eyewitness to James's daring stunt on the suspension bridge shared their account with the BBC News Online, shedding some light on the dramatic sequence of the events. According to this observer, James walked up to the bridge with a determined demeanor, clearly intending to carry out his plan. And this is what the guy saw from his perspective.
Okay.
As James reached the bridge's edge, he proceeded to clip himself onto the rope and harness, a pivotal moment that marked the point of no return in this extraordinary endeavor.
Sure.
The witness then described the heart-stopping climax of James' stunt. After his breathtaking jump, he ignited himself in a bold and dangerous twist, setting his entire body ablaze. In the moments that followed, the witness recounted that James struggled to cut the rope that held him suspended over the bridge, over the abyss, rather. As seconds turned into an agonizing stretch of time, he remained suspended, enveloped in flames, according to this eyewitness. Eventually, the witness stated, it took James more than, in his estimate, 20 seconds. It was 26 seconds to free himself from the rope. Then he plummeted into the water. He wasted no time and quickly swam away from the scene, leaving behind people that were distressed at what they just witnessed.
That had to be something. If you were witnessing this from the bridge itself or from the shore or whatever, you had to be thinking, am I really seeing what I think I'm seeing?
Yeah. I know.
I mean, that would just be surreal.
It's not something one is supposed to witness in life. Other eyewitness accounts provided a vivid and dramatic portrayal of the sequence of events that unfolded during his leap off the bridge. The consequences were immediate and pretty harsh. James Marples suffered burns to his arms and face.
Oh.
He was taken to the Bristol Royal Infirmary and later transferred to a burn specialist unit in Franchet Hospital.
Oy.
He did recover, and as the news of his stunt spread, it drew condemnation from a guy named David Kirk, who is the chairman of the Dangerous Sports Club. He noted the recklessness of James's endeavor. Yes, the chairman of the Dangerous Sports Club is throwing down.
Yeah, even you got to know you've screwed up when the chairman of the Dangerous Sports Club calls you out as an idiot.
He highlighted the lack of proper safety measures. Sergeant Steve Kendall from Avon and Somerset Police described it as a dangerous act that caused distress to many people. The stunt may have fulfilled James' quest for excitement, but it also brought with it consequences that left him physically scarred and facing legal ramifications for his actions.
Wow.
It's a reminder that some thrills come at a high cost, both personally and legally. This came from the BBC Online. And again, it happened in 2004. I have not been able to find any more recent stunts off that particular suspension bridge since this one. Right. So maybe finally we've all learned a lesson.
Maybe so. Or maybe not.
Time will tell.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The stories of the very first Thanksgiving, 3 days of celebrating peace between the Native Americans and pilgrims newly arrived from faraway shores, feasts, games, relaxation, so pleasant to imagine. But guess what? It never really happened. We're Pilgrims Weren't Real, the group devoted to doing away with the story of how Thanksgiving began in America. And we're not just some conspiracy theory group, we're real, but pilgrims weren't. Think about it. If they arrived in America in 1620, this country wasn't even established yet. So where would they have landed? Plymouth Rock? Think about it. The Chrysler Plymouth wasn't even invented until 1928. So how could they have come up with the name of a car that was still centuries away from being produced? Don't buy into the conspiracy. Think for yourself. Could pilgrims really sail all the way here on the Mayflower? It had no GPS, no electricity or satellite TV. How would they have entertained themselves that long or even found their way here? Please consider joining us in our fight to correct history. There were never any pilgrims. And if there were, why don't we still dress like they did and shoot turkeys? Oh, and turkeys aren't real either, but that's a whole separate commercial. Thanksgiving isn't real because pilgrims weren't real. This message has been paid for by Pilgrims Weren't Real, a wholly owned subsidiary of a 501c3 we haven't even named yet because we don't even believe in our own organization. Thanksgiving isn't real because pilgrims weren't real.
Our email address is lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com. Christian writes, "Hey, Boo Crew." I don't know if that's, well, I guess technically.
Yeah. In the grander Boo scope Crew. Of things.
In the grander, under the box umbrella. Okay. All right. "My name is Meatball. I just finished episode 15, and I know I just had the story, the tickle your tootsie, and I had to share it. I worked at a hospital in Texas some odd years ago in radiology as an aide. One night while working, this lady comes into the ER complaining of severe neck pain. So the doctor examines her and orders a scan of her C-spine, that's her upper neck. We get the order and off I go to pick up the patient. I walk in, introduce myself, not as Meatball, I had to use my government name there. probably smart on Meatball's part. Hi, I'm Meatball, I'm here to do your x-ray. She's a very nice middle-aged lady, I think somewhere in Jethro's era. Well, that's kind. People are now approximating story subjects to Jethro's age. After I confirm her identity and tell her what we'll be scanning, I start pushing her stretcher over to the radiology area for her scan. On the way over, I asked, trying to make polite conversation, what brought her in, assuming a car accident or a fall. She chuckles lightly and tells me her husband wanted to spice up the bedroom because he was getting a little tired of the same old routine.
Uh-oh. So, I mean, in my mind, I'm trying to picture what that would be that would cause a spinal injury.
And maybe this is why this podcast is rated as explicit. So he buys a dog collar and a leash.
Oh, no.
For her to wear during their playtime. She agrees to wear it that night, and their activities commence. They're on the bed. He's getting a little too enthusiastic and accidentally shoves her off the bed. He tried to catch her using the only thing he had in his hands at the time. That's right, the dog leash.
Oh, no.
He yanks on it as she's going down, causes what we later determined to be a spinal fracture. Oh, fortunately, she ended up being all right other than the embarrassment and some slight pain. I had to hold my stuff together while in front of the patient, but we laughed till I almost threw up as I recounted the story to the tech who was doing the scan. Still one of my favorite stories from that job. I love both your podcasts. Love you guys, especially Jethro. Daddy vibes. Hi, Cat. Your friendly neighborhood, Meatball.
Thanks, Meatball.
Thanks, Meatball.
It reminds me of a call I got when I was doing a radio morning show from an overnight emergency room technician.
Right.
Where a large lady, a hefty gal, came in because she had been, I guess, eating food. She was at a barbecue and some of it got, a little bit of it got stuck in her throat. It wasn't obstructing her airway or anything. Right. So she was able to breathe, but she couldn't get it out. And so they went to do some x-rays and they had her take off her top. And when they did, a chicken wing fell out from under her breast. and she said she was saving it for later.
I guess there are worse places to hide a chicken in the human body for later consumption. But
yeah.
I give her big points for initiative and creativity.
I wonder where she keeps her car keys.
Yeah. No need to carry a purse. Look where I keep my keys.
Whew.
Well, we thank Christian/Meatball and all the people who continue to send us stories to lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com. I will never look at a chicken wing the same way again.
Hello, everyone. Stakuyi here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
You're in the shallow end with Schnepley and Toth.
I want to thank another listener named Josh for sending this this story idea. It's called Operation Flagship.
Ooh.
And it's a fascinating, fascinating story, if I do say so myself.
It sounds very official.
Doesn't it? This actually goes back to the early 80s, from 1981 to 1986, the U.S. Marshals Service conducted a series of operations that they called Fugitive Investigative Strike Team, or FIST, operations. And the idea was to capture thousands of wanted fugitives here in the U.S. Now, one tactic that these U.S. Marshals used to lure fugitives was a get-something-for-nothing scheme.
Right.
And they were often quite successful. This was first demonstrated in 1984 when they conducted FIST 7, which was a large-scale operation spanning over 2 months in 8 states, and it resulted in the arrest of, get this, 3,309 wow. fugitives.
Fist 7 sounds like the name of a movie that you would rent from behind a curtain.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
You know,
that.
Back in the day. Remember that?
Back in the day. Before, yeah.
Like at Zips in Tucson.
Zips, man. I haven't thought of that in ages.
They had a curtain for all the naughty things.
I'll have to take your word for it because I, sir, never went to Zips. Or if I did, I never went behind the curtain.
All right, fine. That's good enough.
As far as anyone knows. In New York City, these fugitives were sent a notice from the fictitious Brooklyn Bridge Delivery Service to pick up their valuable packages. In Buffalo, fugitives were notified they had won between $250 and $10,000 in a lottery. In Hartford, Connecticut, younger fugitives were notified they'd won 2 free tickets to a Boy George concert, including dinner for 2 and the use of a limo. But in all the cases, the fugitives were arrested when they tried to claim their packages or prizes at a specific locations. For the marshals, arresting fugitives while away from home was significantly safer because they were often caught unarmed and, of course, off guard.
I'm wondering how free Boy George tickets would do nowadays.
Yeah, I'm thinking not well.
No, not with the youngsters.
So in November of 1985, the chief deputy of the U.S. Marshals was a guy named Tobias Roche. And he gets together with a U.S. Marshal named Herbert Rutherford from District of Columbia. And they are talking about the fact that the Washington Redskins, remember they were still named the Redskins then, were incredibly hot. And it was almost impossible to get tickets for their sold-out home games. And in fact, at that time, the waiting list for season tickets lasted years. But these two guys get together and they note that there is a much-anticipated game coming up in December, December 15th, between the Redskins and the Bengals. And the winner of that game would go to the playoffs. So the month before, Roche, and he has got the approval of this guy, Rutherford, came up with this idea. He tells U.S. Deputy Marshals and Fugitive Task Force members of the Washington, D.C. Police Department to mail invitations to the last known addresses of approximately 3,000 wanted persons. Now, the invitations were sent by the fictitious firm Flagship International Sports Television,
okay,
which also spells fist, but of course, people didn't put that together. And the recipients who got these letters are told that it's a firm's promotional offer that they, the recipients, had won 2 complimentary tickets to the Redskins Bengals game, and they were invited to a pregame brunch at the Washington Convention Center on the morning of the game. They were also told they could enter a raffle to win 10 season tickets for the Washington Redskins and the grand prize of a week-long all-expenses-paid trip to New Orleans to watch that year's Super Bowl.
Wow.
Now, these fugitives had all kinds of crimes for which they were wanted, including assault, robbery, burglary, escape, narcotics, rape, arson, fraud, or frequently a combination of those crimes. Oof. Now, they send out 3,000 of these invitations to the last known addresses, and 167 replied saying, yeah, I'm down for that. I'll be there. But Roche wasn't done. He had come up with some clues as to what was really going on. For example, the invitation letters that were sent out by the marshals were signed by the letter I, Michael Detnaw, D-E-T-N-A-W, which is actually wanted spelled backward. And when the fugitives called a specified phone number to confirm their attendance, an operator would redirect them to Flagship's business manager, a guy named Marcus Cran, C-R-A-N, which is actually narc spelled backwards.
Oh, they're just toying with him now.
And the music on hold was I Fought the Law.
Oh, they were clearly having a good time with this.
They were having a good time, and I think they knew that they were not dealing with the brightest bulbs, right? Mm. These 167 people who said, yeah, I'll be there. Still, the ruse is convincing enough that on the morning of December 15th, the day this thing is supposed to go down, a lawyer representing the actual local broadcaster for the Redskins game went to the police command post to issue a cease and desist order saying that Flagship International didn't have the appropriate license to operate in the district. So even good guys are being fooled by this. Now, the marshals and the officers spent a month and a half training for this sting, including three dress rehearsals.
Ooh.
And deputy marshals were brought in from outside D.C. because the planners were feared that some of these fugitives, you know, who've been in and out of jail, might actually recognize these local marshals who had guarded them in courtrooms or taken them to jail. Well, the cops and the marshals get to the convention center at 5:30 a.m. on December 15th to set up this operation. And to minimize the risk, they set up two separate areas in the convention center. One area to greet the guests, in quotes, and another area where they could separate the fugitives in smaller batches to make arrests. And although the invitations indicated these guests should arrive at 9 in the morning, many of them are so jazzed to get these Redskin tickets that they show up at 8 a.m. So to make the scene more believable and festive, these officers carry balloons, they're singing Redskins cheers, they have a buffet brunch, they're playing videos from the very first Super Bowl win. And aside from tuxedos and service crew uniforms, one marshal wore a Redskins war bonnet while another wore a knockoff San Diego chicken suit to parade around the convention center and also check out if any of these fugitives are becoming suspicious.
Uh-huh.
But none of the fugitives had any clue what was going down. So these fugitives would arrive, these marshals would check them in, you know, verify their IDs. Can I see your driver's license? And amazingly, most of these guys were still carrying driver's license.
Wow.
They would verify their identities through phone calls with the backroom staff, and then they gave them color-coded name tags. Now, code words such as double winner were used to warn that a specific fugitive was considered especially dangerous. They had female undercover officers who were dressed as cheerleaders, and they were actually discreetly frisking these fugitives for concealed weapons.
Oh, this is brilliant.
They would come up and give them hugs, congratulatory hugs, and put their arms around their waists while they would escort these fugitives to the next area. So a guy named Lewis McKinney is chief of enforcement operations for the U.S. Marshals. He posed as a top hat wearing master of ceremonies for this program exclusively for the winners. Now, each group of fugitives, and there are like 10 to 20 per batch, were told to sit down in the auditorium to listen to a few remarks, and then told after these remarks, you'll get awarded your prize. So upon mentioning the signal word, surprise, 25 members of the special operations group commanded by U.S. Deputy Marshal William Deegan are all wearing tactical gear. They storm the auditorium. They surround the fugitives who are handcuffed and escorted outside to awaiting buses. A total of 101 fugitives arrested by the end of the operation.
Amazing.
Isn't that genius? This was actually reporters from CBS and the LA Times were invited to document and do coverage, and they were fantastic stories. And in fact, 2016, I don't know if you saw it, NFL Films did a short documentary for that 30 for 30.
Oh, I did not see that. I love 30 for 30.
Yeah. Yeah. ESPN did that in 2017 about the operation, and it's just called Strike Team.
Fist seven,
not what you think. Writing in 2019, authors Jerry Clark and Ed Palatella described Operation Flagship as, quote, one of the most legendary and effective in the history of the U.S. Marshals Services. They attributed its double success to the sheer number of fugitives caught in a single operation while also avoiding the dangers typically associated with capturing them at home or on the streets.
It's just brilliant how they put this together.
And the fact that people would fall for something like that.
I guess that they rightly assumed that people like this are not the brightest bulbs. And
exactly.
And they played it. They used that to their advantage. I love the whole dressing up female officers as cheerleaders to pat them down.
Give them congratulatory hugs and walk them with their arm around their waist to the winner's area. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's genius. Operation Flagship. And again, thanks to Josh, who sent that story idea in. I also, when I saw that, JG, I thought of your son, Josh, just because of the name Josh.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
I just wanted you to know that I paid attention to your children's names.
I appreciate that.
It was a shameless endeavor to endear myself to you even more than I hope I already
am. Well, actually, my son, Josh, created traps, shallow end traps for thieves when he was... a manager at a, I won't say the name of the place, but a major national, international pizza chain. He was the manager of a local location in Tucson.
Right. I think I know the chain you're talking about.
Yeah. And they had a problem with this one guy who it was like every day at the same time. He would burst through the door. He would run to the salad bar. He would grab a fistful of lettuce. He would dunk it in the ranch and then run out the side door. And and this went on for several days. And so Josh, my son, ever the problem solver, made sure that the side door was totally locked. So the next day, same time, guy runs in.
Like a clock. Yeah.
Grabs a fistful of lettuce, dunks it in the ranch dressing, and then runs full out into the door and knocks himself out.
And the police show up to arrest a dazed ranch dressing covered patron.
Yes. Huh?
Not really a patron. No, he was a thief.
He was a thief is what he was.
I wonder why ranch...
I don't know.
I wonder why he didn't try. I guess he was just at an age where he had decided that ranch was his thing.
Yeah, he's apparently...
No messing around with French or Thousand Island or...
He's a discerning salad dressing aficionado.
Yeah, yeah. Good for Josh.
Yeah.
Very smart.
We love hearing from you guys. We love your stories. We love your emails. Lifeguard@shallowendpodcast.com. We look forward to hanging out with you every single week.
And by the way, a very happy day before Thanksgiving. Go hug a pilgrim.
Yeah, and if you can't find a pilgrim, dress up like one and go around and hug strangers. And while you're doing that, frisk them for weapons.
Yeah, always a good call.
We'll see you next time. As always, make good choices.
Your life might depend on it.
So concludes another episode of The Shallow End with Schnebly and Toth. We thank you for listening. Oh, be a dear, would you? Please subscribe to this podcast, give these boys a 5-star rating, and think of something nice to say, even if you have to make something up. And visit us online at shallowendpodcast.com. Okay, gotta go.